Before we get started this morning, this is a message for some of the regular attenders of our church. We would like you to, this week, if you get an opportunity, to log on to our website, and we have a little survey for you to fill out. Now, this survey is called the Church Satisfaction Survey. We want you to rate your worship experiences here at Slate Hill, and to make sure that you're happy. So if you have an opportunity to look at the style of worship, whether we have enough parking spaces in the parking lot. And you know what? We have been dealing with this same coffee for, I think, 12 years, and we haven't had any feedback about that. So you have an opportunity this morning when you log on there to our website to find out whether you like the coffee or not. Now, some of you computer people are good on your screens, maybe already or have your phone out and go onto that website. But before you do, I'd just like to say that this church satisfaction survey isn't going to happen. In fact, if you know us pretty well around here, you know there is no such thing as a church satisfaction survey. That we don't check on the satisfaction and happiness of our customers. But what does happen for you and me and all of us, that we are asked many times to fill out a survey. We expect to have our voices heard. We are familiar with customer service forms and counters. And if we're honest with ourselves, we would admit that we like to be catered to. If my steak is not cooked right, we send it back. If we don't like the service that we receive at some establishment, we ask to talk to the manager. We want people to know whether we're satisfied or not. And so when that happens outside of these four walls, it tends to seep in to the church, these same kind of attitudes, the same kind of spirit. This attitude of, are my opinions most important? Are my preferences being catered to? Am I being noticed? Am I being served? But those of you who've been around here quite a long time, you understand that instead we talk about, am I serving? Am I have a servant's heart? And what's amazing to me is this same spirit that you and I struggle outside these four walls at times and within these four walls, it's amazing to me that we find the same spirit of all places in the upper room that was read in John 13. It was sundown, the final hours of Jesus' life. And Jesus was listening to them arguing about who was the greatest. This was not the first time. In fact, I think it's the third time we read of such an argument among the disciples. And Jesus seems to understand, because he's Jesus, that the time for sermons are over. It was time to do something different. And before the triumphal entry in Mark 10:45, we hear this, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom for many." So Jesus came to be served. Came to serve. But the disciples had a hard time learning that lesson. And yet they watched Jesus time and time again serve others. He heard Jesus say, "The first shall be last. The great becomes the least of these." And so in the world that we live in the world that they lived in the world all of us live in, We hear Jesus' teaching say to turn the other's cheek. But we know that the real answer is to even the score. In the world we live in, we do not pray for your enemies. We defeat the enemies. In the world that we live in, if you want to be first, you elbow and cut your way to the front of the line. In our world, first is first. There's no fuzzy line. In our world, we want to be exalted. We want to be stepped into the spotlight. Because in our world, the exalted are exalted. And so Jesus then came and pronounced these things that we do before he goes to the cross. Jesus makes it very clear that he came to be a servant. Now, this was so counterculture to their time and to our time. And whenever these kind of events that are counterculture that happen in our world, it's funny for me to watch the reaction. Whether it's on a news broadcast, one of these feel-good stories, whenever one of these stories happen where people do something counterculture, it seems to grab us, doesn't it? It seems to shake us and to wake us up a little bit, if it's just for the story or for just a moment or two. One of those stories that was a couple years ago that made the news was this high school junior varsity team was looking for their first victory of the season. It was Woodlands High School junior varsity team versus Tompkins High School. And there they were on a Thursday night playing a game. Woodlands High School had not won a game that year. But this night, that very night, they were within a single point of going ahead towards the end of the game, and they were about to score. But the play before they were about to score, something happened. The opposing team's, one of the players, got seriously injured. So bad, in fact, that they had to call a helicopter, and it landed right into that field. And as they were dealing with the player, and then they flew him away to the hospital, there was a different mood in the stadium that evening. But there was Woodland High School 1 yard away from their first victory. Just 1 yard. Not much time left on the clock. And Woodlands broke out of the huddle and they came to the line in scrimmage. And they did something that you only do when you're just trying to run out the clock. The quarterback took the ball and he took a knee. Not once, not twice, but three times until the clock turned to zero. It caught the attention of so many people in that area that why would this team, who had not ever won that year, would take a knee when they were so close? The players and the coaches were interviewed about that. And they said it was the right thing to do. We have a lot of stories that are newsworthy, where we see glimpses of the counterculture. But if we're honest with ourselves, if I'm honest with myself this morning, I'm more interested at times to pad my stats, to be maybe the greatest, the most important. But less than 24 hours to go, the clock is ticking, and Jesus has one more object lesson that he wants to give the disciples and us. And in that upper room, he walks over and picks up a towel and a wash basin. And as he's doing this, the arguments that they were talking among themselves about who's the greatest started to slowly wane. it got quieter in the room as they saw Jesus pick up a towel and the basin and approaching one by one the disciples and washing their stinky, dusty feet. This task was a task for the lowest of the servants. I mean, it needed to be done because they're going to recline not at a table but around the floor as they would eat, and their feet would be coming close to someone else's nose. And so that was just customary that they'd have their feet washed. What's interesting to me is any of the disciples could have offered to do this. As I think about that story, I put myself into that story. Maybe you ought to put yourself into that story. Because if I was there, I would do the exact same thing. That this is more appropriate for her, I mean for him or her or this person. Never thinking that maybe this would be my task, that maybe this is what I'm called to do. None of the disciples volunteered. And so Jesus washes their feet. And when he's finished, he says, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." What I think this text says is that life will go better, not perfect, if your lives are lived with this type of spirit. This servant's attitude, not padding the stats, not looking to your left or the right, you're lower than me. See, when we serve the way that Jesus illustrated, we don't discriminate in our service. Jesus serves, but he does not serve based on their worthiness, what they can do for him in return. In sermons, there's always a rub, and here's one of these rubs. An honest moment, a transparent moment. That sometimes for me and maybe for you, that my love for others' service to others is often based on what we can get in return. Oh, I know we don't say that, but subconsciously we choose that path. Truthfully, if we're honest this morning, we'd say a lot of times when we serve for getting something in return. This is what Jesus got in return. Jesus serves the disciples knowing full well that just moments later they will abandon him, deny him. And there he was washing the very feet of Judas who will betray him. As I thought about that, it's difficult sometimes to serve people like that. How do you serve a spouse that never has a kind word to say? How do you serve a coworker who always stabs you in the back? How do you serve a father who is always putting you down? How do you serve a friend who always seems to be taking and never giving anything back? See, there was the towel and the basin. And I know at times in my life and maybe in your life that there is times when I'm ready to serve. I have the towel and the basin and I'm ready to do it. But sometimes it's just not quite ready for that. And so I take the towel and I put it back in the closet. I take the basin and I put it away because I can't get there. My pride gets in the way. Jesus did not come to be noticed. Jesus did not come to be great. Jesus did not come to be rewarded. Jesus did not come to be elected. Jesus did not come to be crowned. Jesus came to serve. And he calls us to do the same. And so people like Peter, who denies him, Thomas, who doubts him, Judas, who betrays him, and people like that, knowing full well what is going to happen, he washed their feet, and they served and had a meal together. And then we come to Peter. And we can maybe identify with Peter because of this. Peter says, "You're not washing my feet." Why did Peter say that? Well, I think there's many reasons he may have said that. But I think one of them is he was saying, "I do not feel worthy of your service. I don't feel worthy of your love, Jesus." See, in this story, sometimes the hardest thing is to receive the love of Jesus. But we don't feel worthy. A great story by Tony Campolo, who talked about one of his earliest memories of communion, when he said it was about 7 years old. He said the preacher that day was preaching and talking about grace and forgiveness. He said, "I was there with my family," and he says, "in the pew in front of us with this gal about 20-some years old, was crying the whole way through the sermon. And every time the preacher would say something, she'd shake her head no. Like, no. When he talked about forgiveness and about grace, she could not accept it. She just kept shaking her head no, and she kept crying and sobbing. And then it came time for communion, when they passed the bread and the cup. And Tony says, "I remember my dad in his broken English as he watched the communion cup and the bread pass this lady and shake her head no, this young gal, you know, and his father tapping this young lady on the shoulder in his broken English and said to her, 'Take it, girl. This was meant for you. Do you hear me? This was meant for you.'" And he said she nodded her head and then handed her the bread and the cup. And he said their moment was a change of tears, not of tears of bitterness or shame or guilt, but they were tears understanding and recognizing the meaning of what Jesus came for her. If Jesus was here, he would challenge us to serve others. He would challenge us to do this in remembrance of me. But some here this morning are maybe like Peter, or maybe like that young girl in her 20s, who have a hard time receiving his love that he gives. As we prepare for communion, remember that Jesus came for all of us. He did this for us. We're supposed to do this in remembrance of me. The greatest example that we have is Jesus. And Jesus came not to be served, but to serve.